Today's episode is a bit different, and we wanted to give a warning that this episode deals with potentially distressing material dealing with suicide. This conversation may activate distressing feelings for you. If that's the case, feel free to skip this one. Help is available at the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by calling or texting 988. Today's episode is about investment fraud and the steps you can take to ensure it doesn't happen to you.
Yeah, we're going to talk to James Brandolini, convicted investment fraudster turned anti-fraud advocate. James is going to tell us about his own story, about how he found himself leading a fraud scheme, and about the warning signs of fraudulent investment activity that you should be looking out for.
Hello, my dear listeners, and welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. My name is Mindy Jensen, and with me, as always, is my anti-fraud advocate co-host, Scott Trench.
Thanks, Mindy. Great to be here with you. We're going to have a serious intro today, and we're going to tell everybody that we're here to make financial independence less scary, less just for somebody else, to introduce you to every money story, because we truly believe financial freedom is attainable for everyone, no matter when or where you're starting. And now let's bring in James Brandolini.
James Brandolini, welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Very excited as well. Thanks for inviting me, Scott, Mindy.
James, on an early day in January 2011, you walked into the Chicago Dirksen Federal Building and turned yourself in. Why?
So for 8 years, I ran a Ponzi scheme as a trader at the Chicago Board of Trade, running a hedge fund. And during that period, there was never more than a day or two that went by that I didn't think I could make the money back. Well, after 8 years and $3.8 million later, the realization came. I woke up one morning and said, you know, I'm not going to make it back. So I sold my condo and I gave all my possessions away and found an attorney and walked into the U.S. Attorney's office, like you said, and said, this is who I am. This is what I did. Please arrest me.
Can you define what a Ponzi scheme is, just for those who, you know, I think most people know it's an inappropriate activity, but they don't know the actual definition of it.
Okay. So technically a Ponzi scheme, as everybody knows it, is, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. So where an operator will be running a seemingly legitimate business where the business plan is dictating profits that they're making. In a Ponzi scheme, there are no profits from legitimate trading or legitimate sales or legitimate business, or maybe a small portion. The profits are coming from new investors who are investing money, and that money is used to either show a lavish lifestyle, show success, and to pay investors dividends and returns on previous investments.
Yep. So you're taking the new money from investors and using that to spend on either your lifestyle or pay back the people who invested earlier. And that's what that's illegal. And this has happened many times throughout history.
It happens every day.
Okay, great. So we've defined Ponzi scheme. Let's start from the beginning. How do we set the stage where we got on the path to being into a Ponzi scheme?
So I would say from the very beginning, I always wanted to be a trader on one of Chicago's futures exchanges, the Board of Trade or the Mercantile Exchange. And it really started when I was at the end of my freshman year in high school with the release of the movie Trading Places with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. And just that wild trading scene at the end when they're trying to corner the frozen concentrated orange juice market. That really kind of got me excited about trading. And that's really all I ever wanted to do. I ended up running a trading desk at a now defunct firm called MF Global. And while I was there, I designed a trading program that traded treasury bonds, bond futures, mind you. And really, the end of 99, I had been trading this for a few years, and I decided that I wanted to go out on my own. And basically started a fund and became a member of the Board of Trade. And I was going to, you know, trade money and do really, really well. So in my case, it was really simple. When I became a member of the Board of Trade, before I even started trading for the fund, I was on the floor waiting for the IT department at the Board of Trade to come in and put in my phone line and all of my internet stuff at the desk. And I'm kind of walking around, and I had more than a few positions on the floor, so I knew how it worked. And although I'm trading bonds, which is slightly less volatile than, say, the Dow Jones or the S&P indices, I was just mesmerized by how the orders coming in from big firms would move the Dow Jones futures market. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, if I could just make a few adjustments to my trading models – and I could raise my you know, my 6.5-7% returns trading bonds to 9-11% you know, trading S&Ps and Dow futures, you know, I'll be a hero. And really, in a matter of probably a couple hours, I decided to do that. I went to my models, I made some changes, I did some quick back testing, and within a week, I started trading. So my first week of actually trading for the new fund, I was down about 3%.
Well, let's back up. Let's back up just 1 second here in the story here. So you left your job and set this fund up. This was in what year?
So in June of 99, I left MF Global and I started a small independent futures brokerage firm called Lloyd Lewis, in which I would be able to solicit customers as a broker for this system, kind of like the intermediate step between leaving the brokerage firm and starting the fund. I wanted to be able to kind of test it with real customers as a broker, which means I would only be able to charge commissions. I did that until the beginning of 2003. And then in February of 2003, that's when I became a member of the Board of Trade and started the hedge fund. And during that 3 year period, I had a positive track record, which gave me the confidence to go out and start the fund.
Awesome. So that's super helpful here. So you start a fund. Who are your investors and what is your incentive structure in this fund?
The incentive structure is standard 2%, 220. So 2% management fee of all the assets every year, and then 20% of profits. And that's really why someone would start a hedge fund, is because they want a piece of the action, right? So the more profits that you make for clients, the more money that you can grab for yourself. My clients really were my brokerage firm clients that I had for 3-4 years, family, friends of family. So everybody in my fund I knew personally.
We're taking a quick break. And when we're back, we'll hear about how a career at a futures brokerage turned into a multi-million dollar fraud scheme.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages. Until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right, get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
Real estate investing is great, but for some, the tenant phone calls and clogged toilets aren't all that attractive. So how do you invest in real estate without getting your hands dirty? Invest for truly passive income with Pine Financial Group. Pine's mortgage fund offers an 8% preferred return and an attractive profit split, with 70% of profits going to the investors. You'll earn passive income by participating in lending to house flippers. And it's secure because senior lien holders, that's you, get paid first. Their rigorous underwriting process and the backing of the physical asset provide additional security in case of borrower default. Plus, by investing with Pine Financial Group, you contribute to the revitalization of communities by redirecting your funds from Wall Street to Main Street, supporting local economies and generating profits simultaneously. This investment is reserved for accredited investors, but if you are not accredited, Pine Financial has options for you too. Take control of your investments and secure a stable 8% annual return today. Visit pinefinancialgroup.com/biggerpockets to learn more about the fund. That's pinefinancialgroup.com/biggerpockets.
When it comes to financial guidance, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When Mindy and I want to upgrade our wallets, we turn to NerdWallet.
Scott's right. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products.
Before NerdWallet, Mindy and I were paying for vacations in cash, missing out on miles, and not even knowing what we're leaving on the table.
But now we're flying through the skies for free, thanks to our new cards with more miles and upgrades than ever.
So if you want more travel rewards, hotel upgrades, or airport lounge access, no matter where you go next, let NerdWallet help you make it happen with a killer travel card.
Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at NerdWallet.com.
NerdWallet, finance smarter.
As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply.
And we're back. We're talking to James Brandolini about the worst decision he made and how it led to him running an investment fraud scheme for 7 years. Awesome. And how much did you raise?
$2 million.
$2 million. Okay. So 2% of $2 million is $40,000 per year. That's kind of like a base salary, right? That's what a lot of these private equity or whatever, it's a very standard commission model, 2 and 20, for incentivizing folks who manage capital. And that would be, hey, that's your salary. And then you get 20% of the profit. So if you grow the $2 million to $4 million, you would get 20% of the $2 million in profits, which is really what motivates folks in this type of model. Is that right?
Absolutely. The management fees just kind of, keep the lights on and maybe we'll pay the rent and a few of the expenses. But where the big bonuses come in is when, is on the incentive side, when you can make a profit and grab 20% of that profit.
Awesome. This is super helpful context setting because, again, legitimate trading, making a good profit, track records established, we're raising a fund, and not even, I would say, even in 2003, a particularly large fund. This is a very standard sized fund. It probably happens every day with folks here. And it's with folks who have grown to trust you over either a lifetime or over several years in the professional field. Is that right? All correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, let's keep going. So what happens next?
After the first week of trading, I'm down about 3%. In my documents, I had a clause that if I was down 3% in any one, in any point of the month, I would stop trading and begin trading the next month. So I had about 2.5 weeks before the statements would be prepared and mailed out by a CPA firm that I had hired. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And, yes, I know everybody and everybody likes me, but it's my first month. I'm down 3%. A lot of people are going to pull their money out. And then what am I going to do now? Right. And I was just kind of thinking of ways of how I'm going to, address my initial set of investors. And I'm sitting in an office with a colleague of mine and he's on the phone and I'm paging through maybe Institutional Investor magazine. And the light bulb goes off. I see an advertisement for hedge fund accounting software. And I'm thinking, here's the answer. Let me buy this software and put everybody's name into it, send statements for a month or two. I'll get the money. I'll show a gain. I'll get the money back. I mean, I've been trading for a long time, right? I mean, I had been trading since college. So I've been trading for a long time. I can make 3% back, no problem at all. And that's what I did. I sent false statements out. That first month thinking that I could make funds back and I didn't. And so we're looking at minus 3%, minus 5%, minus 10%, minus 20%, and so on. So that was really stage one of the fraud. That lasted for about a year and a half. Stage two comes in when I'm running a little bit low on money and I'm thinking, well, I'm a sales introvert. And I didn't want to go to my clients and ask them for more money. So what do? I, liquidate my 401k, my insurance policy, get a home equity line of credit, and throw my personal net worth into the fund. And that lasted probably almost another year and a half. So now we're at the 3-year mark. And up to this point, it's civil crime. It's making false statements, sending false statements in the mail, but I've not taken a penny. All of the trading was legitimate and all the losses were legitimate. And it just happened to be, I'm really thinking of how am I going to get in front of everybody and let everybody know? And are they going to, go to the authorities? And they probably will. And okay, it is what it is. And I get a phone call from a random individual who is a friend of one of my bigger clients and who wants to invest. And he decides to write a check for $500,000. And I'm thinking, well, here we go. Now, I've got like no money to live on. Now I can at least, take a small, illegitimately, of course, I can take money from the fund and pay business expenses. And I can hire other people to help me fix my models and make this work. And really from year three is really where the criminal side of the fraud began, from year three to year eight.
So let me just, make sure I've got this right. So we start the fund in 2003. We immediately, first month, have a small loss, nothing that would have, potentially you know, set off any flags, although it's a point of pride and ego, right? I started this thing off and couldn't get there. And then that starts the first small lie, which compounds over the course of the next year, but the next 3 years, sorry, to this point where we're about to hear the next stage in the story. During that period, you know, looking back, was it possible? Would it have been possible for you to just have a big month that eliminated all of the problems? Like, would that have been, do you think some portion of people who start down that path get saved by that miraculous month, or was it never going to happen?
Absolutely. I mean, if even, you know, I had losing months that were greater than 3% when I was managing the money as a broker, right? You know, we had, you know, 4% and 5% losing months, not many of them. And then the market would turn around and we'd have, you know, a couple decent months and then back to kind of normal. And, you know, we'd stay on track. To answer your question, yes, I could have made it back. I was just so darn afraid, Scott, in terms of, you know, what's everybody going to say? Are they going to pull their money out? Am I going to have to close the fund? You know, I spent, you know, at that time, probably 15, 20 grand just on legal expenses to get all the documents done, et cetera, et cetera. You know, what am I going to do?
Well, let's pick it up. What happens in 2006 or thereabouts, 3 years in?
So that's really the point when I started to, you know, embezzle money to live on and to pay for business expenses. And that, you know, that's where the criminal side started. And what's interesting, and not just in my case, but in many cases of investment fraud, most cases of investment fraud don't begin as investment fraud, right? Most people don't wake up one day and say, you know what, I want to steal $5, $10, $20, $100 million. And they get paperwork and they start a website and they open up a bank account and they go and they raise all this money. And then as soon as that the phone rings or somebody knocks on the door, they've got the corporate jet ready to go to Brazil or wherever they're going to go to hide from the authorities.
I think what's really interesting psychologically is, hey, the first 3% loss, it's not acceptable, but you can empathize with, I can make it back and prove that out, right? And the lesson learned here is never go down that first step ever, because everything else is a derivative of that first month's decision, really, in the path that puts you on here. But what, you know, that you said at some point there was a clear movement into criminal with embezzlement. What psychologically kind of went through your head, or what was the moment at that point? Did you realize it and know that you were crossing whatever the step was here, this was way beyond the line that anyone would find acceptable. What was going on in your head at that point?
At that point, I didn't, you know, understand probably the definition of civil and criminal, but I knew that after I deposited that $500,000 check and probably took $10,000 and moved it over to my personal account, that, you know, that was changing the game, because I was now there was a loss, not just with trading, but there was a loss that I was actually, you know, using client funds for business and personal expenses.
How did you cope with it personally?
I think myself personally, I compartmentalized what I was doing. And even though I absolutely knew what I was doing was wrong, I mean, there's no doubt about it at all. I just really tried to focus on, you know, I'm making the money back. And that's what I just kept telling myself. You know, I can make this money back. I know I can make it back. And, you know, it never happened. But that was my mindset.
Because we're going into 2008, 2009, 2010, I remember that time period in the market, and the market just kept going down, 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 down. So,
well, it was getting crushed. And don't forget, December of 2008 is when the Madoff scandal broke. And I mean, I can remember being sitting in Ceres restaurant, which is inside the lobby of the Board of Trade, and Rick Santelli, who was the CNBC rock star commentator from the bond pit at the Board of Trade, he was holding court with a bunch of traders and just kind of went on this rant. Yeah, this is really serious, and that this happened and a lot of people lost a lot of money. But the only benefit that we're going to see is that, you know, we're going to learn what stops investment, you know, what causes investment fraud, and the SEC and the media are going to kind of partner up and make sure this doesn't happen again, which of course, unfortunately, couldn't be further from the truth. But, you know, I had clients who probably got a little bit nervous, who who would call a little bit more often. Hey, can we come down and see you? Or, hey, can you clarify this on your statements and all that kind of stuff? And yeah, it was a little bit more nerve-wracking for me, but they just didn't ask the right questions. And when they asked the right questions, they just didn't know how to prove what I was saying, if it was right or if it was wrong. And I would say that's probably in terms of investors who are looking at investments, some can't ask the right questions and some will get the documents and the marketing literature and they'll read it, but they won't quite understand what's there or what's missing. And when they read it, they just have no way to kind of align with, you know, what should the company be doing versus are they doing what they say they're doing? And that's the key right there.
What did most of your clients think was happening during this period?
You know, they thought we were doing, you know, 1.5% to 2%, 2.5% per month trading, you know, trading futures.
Did you ever show them a loss?
I think I had probably maybe 6 or 7 losses, you know, in that, you know, 0.5% to maybe 1.25%, but nothing really major.
So 2008, Bernie Madoff happens. Essentially, you are doing the same thing, similar thing, but on a smaller scale. You waited 3 years to turn yourself in. What led to that decision?
It's interesting. You know, I wake up one Sunday morning and I'm standing on the balcony. This is probably November of 2010. And I'm standing on my balcony looking, you know, downtown Chicago. And I'm like, you know, I'm never going to make this back. It's been, you know, it's only, you know, $3.8 million. That's not a lot of money when looking at other types of fraud, but you know, I'm not going to make it back. I'm just done. And I could have raised more money. And I was just tired and just done with everything, tired of the lying and the charades and the whole thing. I said, you know what, you know, I'm going to turn myself in.
Yeah. In terms of the Bernie Madoff scandal, that was $20 billion in cash losses and $65 billion in paper losses. So I can see from your point of view, oh, it's only 3 million. It's not nearly so bad.
Right.
So, but yeah, it was 3.8 million that you raised in its entirety. What did investors think the pile had grown to?
That number, probably a couple hundred million. And that's what new money coming out as well, or new money being invested as well.
So investors thought they had a couple hundred million dollars with you that you had grown over 8 years.
Correct.
But you had really lost most of 3.8 million or all of 3.8 million. Is that right?
Correct.
How much did you have left in the coffers by the time you turned yourself in?
25 grand.
Wow. And so what happens next? How you turn yourself in? You're charged. What judicial civil items come up, and how does this progress from there?
I hadn't the slightest idea what to expect, and you know, I went to an attorney, and the attorney is like, you know, don't turn yourself in. You don't want to do that. He really discouraged me from doing so, and I'm like, well, it's only me. There's no other, you know, conspirators to this crime. He goes, look, there's no benefit, you know, of what you're going to do here. So he goes, why don't you just go to California, learn how to surf, and we'll watch the, you know, the federal and the state internet filings. And if your name comes up, we'll give you a call, and you know, you won't have to even go to court for probably 2-3 years, maybe a little bit longer. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why the heck would I wait so long to, you know, to do that? And he goes, well, he goes, do you know anybody who's committing a crime on the floor? I go, well, of course, you know, all the floor traders and all the tricks that they do to steal money from customers. That's really, really difficult to find. He goes, maybe we can go to the U.S. attorney and, you know, you could be a mole. You could wear a wire and you could, you know, try to, you know, he didn't use the word entrap, but that's basically kind of what it would be, of others doing other crimes. And I'm like, you know, no, let's just do it. So he actually went on vacation, for a couple of weeks. This is getting closer to Christmas. And I really had a mental breakdown and I decided that I was going to end it. So what I did was I went to a firearm store outside of the city of Chicago and purchased a firearm and basically attempted suicide, on January the 4th of 2011. And the firearm did not go off and it locked on me. And that's what saved my life. And then as I went back to my condo, I talked to my attorneys, like, oh, I can see you're serious. You know, I'll call the U.S. Attorney's office and try to find the best of the worst. And 2 days later, I'm sitting with the U.S. Attorney and with the FBI. And I basically tell them, you know, this is what I did. This is how I did it. And here's all my clients. And, you know, where do we go from here?
Wow, this is really, really a powerful story. Thank you for sharing all of this. What happens next? You talk to the attorneys, the attorney general. You're talking all this. What are the mechanics of how things transpire from there?
It was one count of mail fraud, sending fictitious financial statements in the mail. With the federal system, it's a little bit different than the state system. So in that charge, the number, the money, there, it's like a point system, right? So besides your charge, you know, because I had over 50 victims, there was extra points for that, because I was, you know, depending upon the loss amount, you get extra points for that. So I received a sentence. My range was 8 to 10 years, and I received 9 years, a 9 year sentence. And then I am obligated to pay restitution every month that goes into a victim fund.
Okay. And then how much of that sentence how much time did you actually spend in jail before, being released?
I served 6.5 years.
6.5 years in prison, before being released. And you got out at what point?
I got out in June, the end of June of 2017.
Okay. So June 2017. And I understand that you decided to start studying other fraud cases and speaking to other fraudsters in prison. And you have then since made identifying, preventing, prosecuting, some combination of those things, your profession, starting in prison and then following prison. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, probably early on, you know, I think everyone thinks that, you know, what am I going to do when I get out? And, you know, I had no other, you know, skill set. You know, I didn't know how to lay brick or pour concrete or, you know, drive a truck or anything like that. What am I going to do? And I really kind of decided, well, maybe there's an avenue that I can take to help prevent fraud. And as I spoke to dozens and dozens of other financial fraudsters, spent a lot of money sending me, you know, forensic accounting textbooks and fraud examination textbooks that I kind of devoured. And the more I studied, you know, the red flags, you know, they're all the same. And they were the same back in the, you know, 40s, 50s and 60s as they were in the 70s and 80s, as they were for, you know, my case in the 2000s. And nothing has really changed. So, you know, my whole, you know, mission became that I was going to tell my story, but really kind of share, you know, the dozens and dozens of red flags that are out there, you know, that fraudsters use that really hasn't changed in a long, long time.
All right, we're taking a quick ad break. And when we're back, James Brandolini will break down the telltale warning signs of fraudulent investment activity.
When it comes to financial guidance, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When Mindy and I want to upgrade our wallets, we turn to NerdWallet.
Scott's right. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products.
Before NerdWallet, Mindy and I were paying for vacations in cash, missing out on miles, and not even knowing what we're leaving on the table.
But now we're flying through the skies for free, thanks to our new cards with more miles and upgrades than ever.
So if you want more travel rewards, hotel upgrades, or airport lounge access, no matter where you go next, let NerdWallet help you make it happen with a killer travel card.
Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com.
NerdWallet, finance smarter.
As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval, and terms of each credit card issuer apply.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
Deciding how to invest your capital can be extremely challenging, especially when the market is constantly changing. That's why it's never been more important to partner with a company that has a great track record. The BAM Capital executive team has successfully navigated through the Great Recession, COVID-19, and the current interest rate environment while delivering maximized returns to their partners. BAM Capital is a trusted multifamily syndicator with over $1.3 billion in transactions, delivering a historical average of over 35% IRR with an average hold period of 3.5 years. BAM Capital has consistently paid preferred return distributions for over 50 consecutive months, has not lost limited partners capital, and has not called capital past the subscription amount. BAM Capital's disciplined investment strategy is targeting undermanaged institutional quality trophy assets throughout the U.S. heartland for accredited investors who are looking for generational wealth building or monthly income opportunities. Their offerings target cash flow stability, capital preservation, long-term appreciation, and accelerated tax benefits. Join BAM Capital's over 1,200 investors across 44 states and get started today at BAMCapital.com. Again, that's BAMCapital.com.
You're trying to close on your next rental, so why is your insurance company dragging its feet? With long lead times and never-ending paper forms, it's no wonder it takes forever to finally get a policy. Modern investors deserve better. They deserve Steadily.com. At Steadily.com, you'll get fast, affordable landlord insurance available online 24/7 in just a few clicks. You can even get next-day coverage, which takes just minutes, by the way, to obtain. And you can do it all from your phone. Steadily was founded by landlords who created insurance products tailored to the unique needs of this industry. It's their sole focus, and that's why landlords nationwide consistently rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars. So whether you've got a single family, short-term, or multifamily portfolio, Steadily.com can secure the best coverage at the best price to protect your properties. Discover how Steadily can save you both time and money on your rental property insurance. Visit Steadily.com for a commitment-free quote tailored to your needs today. This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. We're talking to James Brandolini about if and how you can prevent investment fraud from happening to you.
What was the eureka moment where you kind of began settling on some of these? And can you tell us what those red flags are?
Sure. So I would say, not sure if it was a eureka moment so much as just, you know, as I was speaking to a lot of the financial fraudsters that I was incarcerated with, you know, they're saying all the same things. I would say probably some of the top ones are audits. So in my case, probably 3 months after I started my fund, 3 months into my fraud, so to speak, I get a phone call from, you know, one of my parents' good friends who invested $100,000 with me. Hey, Jimmy, you know, a couple of us are looking for audited financials. You know, can you send, do you have those and can you send them over? It's like, yeah, I'll take care of it for you. Not a problem. And it was a matter of, God, what am I going to do? So go to Google, hedgefundaudit.pdf, and try to find a hedge fund that was similar to mine, and basically kind of copied it almost word for word, and did the, you know, came up with a phony accounting firm, did a website for a phony accounting firm, with a New York address that nobody ever mailed anything to or ever called the number that was listed on there. There were so many mistakes in that audit that if my investors didn't notice it, which they probably wouldn't, their CPAs, who I know looked at them, should have easily recognized the red flags of the mistakes I made because I wasn't, you know, a CPA. So that would be number one. Next, the 3-4 days after the beginning of the year, starting in 2004, I get a call from one of my investors. Hey, Jimmy, when is your accounting firm going to send the tax documents? We want to start doing our taxes. And I'm thinking, oh boy, this is it. I'm done, right? I mean, what am I going to do? There's no way. I got this fraud going on. And okay, we're a year into it. I'm maybe down, you know, 20%, 25%, whatever it was at that time. You know, I could make it back, but there's no way I'm going to commit, you know, tax fraud, right? And what am I going to do? So I kind of just came up with this lie that, you know, with hedge funds, you don't pay tax until you pull the money out. And not only did they believe it, but I had probably over the 8 years, probably 12 to 15 conversations with their attorneys or CPAs talking about that. And nobody ever, ever, ever questioned it. I mean, I had to do a lot of dancing when I was explaining it to them, but nobody ever called one of their colleagues who, you know, worked with hedge funds to say, hey, is this right? Is this true? And just never verified with what I was doing. Another thing. So I was always very open and transparent about people wanting to come and visit me on the trading floor. And I had a newer client who's with me 3 months come, and he came with his CPA. And he says, you know, we'd like to see your trading for these first 3 months. I'm like, okay, no problem. So I'm thinking, well, you know, is he smart enough to know the futures business? And I'll give you an example of what happened. So I pulled the first 3 months from my file cabinet of all the trades that I did. And my office was inside of the brokerage room, my clearing firm at the Board of Trade. We walked to the back office and I said, hey, this is a CPA. He's with my client here. Pull the three trades, the 3 months of trading that I did that you got from the Board of Trade. And they pulled all three monthly statements and they all matched. And the CPA was like, oh yeah, this is fine. If the CPA had any knowledge of futures trading, he would have realized that the size that I was trading or the amount of contracts that I was trading was probably commensurate if I was trading a $10 million fund versus, you know, at that time, I probably said I had a $50 million fund. So if he were to, you know, if I would have looked at it, you know, as a fraud examiner, I would have said, wow, you're not really trading very much. You're trading really very light. But him not being familiar, you know, with the futures market and how it operates, he had no idea to say that. So, you know, it's just it's amazing. And those are three of just bigger ones that are out there.
As a layperson coming into this, you know, things that, you know, from documentaries and other stuff that I've seen, like you think, okay, these guys, they show super smooth returns. Like that was one of the things in the Bernie Madoff Netflix documentary, right? Like the people were challenging him because it was like, wow, the level, the tightness of the return relative to the risk profile of these returns compounded over a really long period of time is just absolutely bonkers. And nobody ever will do that. It's just almost mathematically impossible to get something that smooth. It sounds like your returns were similar to that, right? Always within a narrow band, only a few months, you know, showing losses for it and all that. Is that another red flag or common theme in a lot of these?
So, yeah. So my returns weren't quite as streamlined as Madoff's were, but they were overall, they were definitely outside of the ordinary. And in the red flag report that I do, I'll look at, you know, a time series of all the returns that are being projected and try to find other benchmarks and just try to show that there's certain mathematical rules that will show anomalies in numbers when they are construed, right? So if I'm picking, so every month I picked out a rate of return. So let's say this month we're going to make 1.24%. And next month we're going to make 1.63%. And the next month, we're going to be down 0.74%. So when you're picking your monthly returns that way, there are certain mathematical clues that we can pull out that won't show fraud, but it'll show that they were construed, right? And I've done those with my numbers and with Madoff's numbers. And it's just amazing to see people who fudge numbers, how easy it is to kind of to see that. But yeah, you're right. Now, there are big hedge funds out there, and I'm not going to mention names, that have been around for a long time that are doing 20, 30, 40% a year, and sometimes even more, but they're going to have volatility. They're going to have your 5%, 8% winners for the month, and then they're going to have, 5%, 8%, 10% losses, monthly losses. So it's going to, average out. But when you don't have that downward volatility, and, it's really, like you just said, it's risk adjusted returns. For this return, how much risk am I taking? And when your risk that you're taking on your numbers is so much less than what you can get anywhere else, something's probably amiss.
It also seems to me, as a layperson, that, this, yeah, let me open my books to you. Here's the statements. Here's all that stuff in real time is like almost like too much. And when someone is giving you that much openness and coming in with there, that there's like a little bit of a red flag that should be going off to some degree. Like, yeah, look, I'll prove that I did this, here around that. Like, no one asked you for that, from this. Or like, if there's something remarkable and then an overeagerness to share in the name of transparency, it's almost like a red flag. It comes across as disingenuous. And a few instances in my career, where that's happened, right? Let me prove I do all these things, with that. The second is this total lack of transparency, like what I think Madoff did, where there was just nothing that they really got besides the statements, in there. I guess that wasn't, maybe he was more in the first category, but are those two items to look for as well? Again, I'm not an expert on this. I'm just spewing things that I've picked up from documentaries and stuff.
So with Madoff, it's a little bit easier only because, he would never, clients would ask for an audit and he would never show it to them. Well, I don't want Goldman Sachs to find out what I'm doing and reverse engineer what I'm doing. But here's the thing about an audit's not going to give away any trade secrets, right? And, having transparency in a back office, and how you do things and how you process trades and how you do statements, that's not giving any secrets away in terms of how you're actually, picking which stocks to buy or sell, right? Or which properties to buy or sell. A back office is a back office. Really in terms of audits, what we're really looking for is, to verify if the assets exist, how the assets being valued. Are the performance returns real and are the assets being custodied correctly? And that's just so, so important to be able to do that. And, whether an investor is able to do it or, they hire someone to do it. But, the second part of that, I can have an audit. I would say part of my business, people call me and they'll ask, they'll say, I've invested in something. Would you take a look at it? And I'll have the paperwork and, they'll usually say, well, don't let the company know that, that I hired you. On the other side of it, which I much more prefer, is somebody calling me up and saying, hey, I've got this investment. I've got all the documents. I've got all the paperwork. The manager knows you're going to call him. He's expecting a call from someone. And everything is out in the open. But even with that case, Scott, I could have that audit in my hand. And it's going to say who the CPA firm is. I've got to, if it's a name that I don't recognize, I've got to verify, if the CPA, if he's a real person, if he's a real CPA, which is relatively easy, right? You can go to cpaverify.org. But also too, has that audit been misused? Meaning, a lot of times people, if I'll call up a CPA firm and they won't even say whether they've done the audit. They won't even confirm that. And it's really difficult because you don't know, somebody could have done that audit and maybe the fraudster took a page or two and just added, a couple zeros in a couple different places. And yes, they did the audit, but the audit's fake, right? So it's so, so important once you've got the audit that you're able to verify the authenticity of the audit.
So how do I know that I'm getting correct information when I'm asking my hedge fund manager questions and he's giving me plausible sounding answers like, with hedge funds, you don't pay taxes until you pull the money out? I mean, that sounds, if I don't know anything about hedge funds, you just said that I don't have to pay taxes. So how do I know, how do I get this correct information?
As an investor, it'd be probably a little bit tougher, but you would go to your attorney or your CPA and they should know the answer. And if they didn't know the answer, that would be, you know, that's where the problem lies. I'll give you a great little story. I'm sitting with one of my larger clients. His son, who I've known for years and years and years, is a CPA, has a small little firm down in Chicago, and we're getting finished with lunch. And he says, okay, so have you asked, you know, Jimmy everything? He goes, yeah, but I just can't understand how a hedge fund could, you know, can be exempt from paying taxes unless it's in an IRA. And of course I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm done now. That's it. You know, he's figured it out. And, you know, why he didn't call somebody, one of his, you know, colleagues to ask that question. Because I mean, look, a hedge fund is, or a private equity or a real estate fund, all they are is either a limited partnership or an LLC. And they're all, everybody's K-1'd at the end of the year. It's nothing rocket science, right? So for him not to know that or ask me that, I'm just appalled, you know? And every once in a while, I think about it and how I got away with this for 8 years and all of the other red flags that, you know, that the CPAs and attorneys, you know, didn't recognize. It never ceases to amaze me that I got away with it for as long as I did. And it's not just me, you guys. It happens every single day.
So let's tie this in with a really uncomfortable conversation here very quickly, right? And I'm going to use the real estate syndication space, right? Which is right now, I think a lot of people raised a lot of capital to buy apartment complexes. You talked about 2 in 20, where you get 2% of the profits or 2% of the capital amount raised in assets under management fees, and then you get a 20% profit interest. Syndications make that look like a weak compensation model. These guys get paid 1% to 2.5% just to buy the real estate. Then they get the 2%. Management fee. Then they get a 1 to 2.5% if they refinance the property, and another 1 to 2.5% if they exit the property. Then they get 20 to 30% carried interest. Right. So incentives are right there. A lot of investors have invested in these types of syndications over the last couple of years, and they're losing right now. Asset values have gone down dramatically. Some of them have already been exposed as Ponzi schemes or frauds at this point, and you're already seeing prosecutions in that. As an investor, how can I protect myself in the real estate syndication space through all of this? And how do I, if I'm invested in something that's losing, determine if it was fraud, bad luck, gross negligence, some other combination of that? How can I parse that out without complete information and without being a forensic accountant who studied this as a profession like you do?
Yeah. You know, the real estate field makes it a little bit more difficult sometimes to do it, only because you have to go and verify if the assets are real, and you have to see how they're registered, and you've got to, you know, go to the courthouse or wherever you can go, and you can check if these how they're custodied and where they're located. You know, I think the big scheme, I'm going to take a half a step back here, if you don't mind, Scott. You know, besides crypto, I think real estate syndication, real estate, you know, whether they're family homes or multifamily, is probably the largest sector of fraud that I'm seeing in terms of more fraud happening. I'm investing in a case right now in Colorado. An ex Denver Bronco invested over $500,000 in a multifamily, well, let's just say snafu, right? So, and the money's pretty much gone. So I'm not sure kind of what's going to happen there. But it's a really bad situation. So I think one of the reasons why we're seeing a lot more fraud in the multifamily space, especially, is because, and I don't want to sound condescending at all, but, you know, you've got a lot of Joe Smiths in Kansas City who have bought 30, 40 doors and they're experts in the multifamily space and want to raise money, and they raise money and the deal starts going bad, and you know, they're moving, say they've got three or four deals, capital raises they've have, and you know, one or two of the deals is not doing well, and they've got a deal that's doing extremely well, so they're going to take money from one deal and put it to the other and not disclose that. And that's where a lot of problems are taking place. But to go back and answer your question, so since most investment fraud does not start out as investment fraud, it's really, really difficult to pinpoint it. I mean, you know, a lot of these, the syndications, many of them will have audited financials, and it's a matter of going through them with a fine-tooth comb and verifying everything that's on there, and probably even having a forensic accountant go and look at it. And even some of the cases that I get hired for, you know, I've got a forensic accountant that will, you know, on stuff that gets really intricate, will help me with, you know, the procedures of the back office and how everything's kind of working, because some of this stuff is just really, really in depth. But you've got to go through the financials, and you have to, you've got to look at the books. And a lot of firms will not, even especially the small ones, will not let you look at the books. And it's a matter of you know, if an investor's, you know, on their own trying to do it themselves, you know, they've got to say, look, either you let me look at them, or I'm going to hire somebody, and you know, we're going to charge potential fraud, and we're going to see what's going on here, because you know, something's just not right.
Well, James, this has been super helpful. Thank you for sharing all of this with us today. Where can people find out more about you?
They can go to my website at theinvestmentfraudguy.com, and anyone can send me an email at james@theinvestmentfraudguy.com with any questions. I'd be happy to give my opinion and help you out.
Well, appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your story and for the work you're doing now to prevent and find fraud.
Yeah. Thank you, James. This was very interesting. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Mindy.
Wow, Scott, that was James Brandolini, the investment fraud guy. And that was a very interesting episode. I don't know how I would have reacted if I had been investing with him, because he had an answer for everything. And I mean, it really feels plausible that you don't pay taxes until you pull the money out with a hedge fund if you've never invested in a hedge fund before. It also seems completely implausible that you don't pay taxes. Spoiler alert, the government is always going to get theirs. So I'm glad he was able to share some bits at the end about, you know, talk to your network, talk to your friends, talk to other people and ask them these questions if it still seems a little hinky.
I think today's lesson, today's interview was a sobering one. It sounds like without being a forensic accountant who's going to study this stuff for years, it's really difficult in a practical sense to expect yourself to be able to spot fraud, right? I mean, you got to call out the audit inconsistencies on there, or you know, go back and do the research for the audit firm. That's great. Let's have more people do those kinds of things and make it harder. But these fraudsters are going to be one step ahead in many of these cases, right? Some of the mistakes he made are probably ones that the next fraudster is going to be able to overcome in some of these things. It's scary because these people don't start out as fraudsters. I believe that, right? I believe that nobody starts out, or very few people start out, with the intent to rob people of millions of dollars in this, and that it's more about, you know, I couldn't deliver the returns, and so I'm going to fudge them and see if I can get back. And then it becomes out of hand and it spirals from there. How many people are legitimate or seem legitimate today who went down that path, but won and had that good month that saved them and were able to get back out of that spiral that led to James' Ponzi scheme? You know, how many people are in the process of that right now, pretending like they have that? It took 8 years for this thing to be exposed. I mean, it's so scary. Right. People thought they were worth like there was $100 million more in the fund than there was in there. It's just, I think the lesson is you never know, and you can't concentrate all your bets in one area in these kind of unregulated or private syndication or hedge fund opportunities. And you always got to have in the back of your mind that no matter who you're working with, this is a possibility, and that you're just acknowledging that if you're going to get into any of these private investing spaces, and try to make it as difficult as possible for someone to do that especially if you're with them for a long period of time and the returns seem great the entire time. Maybe that's the lesson.
Well, and you just said something, Scott. You said it took 8 years for it to be exposed. It wasn't even exposed. He turned himself in. Nobody caught on to this.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, yeah.
I am very thankful that he came and shared this story with our listeners today so they can start to think about what's going on in their investments if they have hired somebody to take care of them. So ask questions. And if you don't like the answer, keep asking until you understand what they're saying or until you uncover something. I hope you don't uncover anything. Keep asking until until you understand what they're saying. That's where I'll stop. All right, Scott, should we get out of here?
Let's do it.
That wraps up this episode of the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. He, of course, is the Scott Trench, and I am Mindy Jensen saying toodaloo, Yorkie Poo.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple. And if you're looking for even more money content, feel free to visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/biggerpocketsmoney.
Bigger Pockets Money was created by Mindy Jensen and Scott Trench. Produced by Kaylin Bennett. Editing by Exodus Media. Copywriting by Nate Weintraub. Lastly, a big thank you to the Bigger Pockets team for making this show possible.
The market is changing. Finding your way can be tricky. Rates shift, headlines whirl, but your goal hasn't changed. You want financial freedom. And the best investors know it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. If you're ready to get into the real estate investing game or take your game to the next level, finding an investor-friendly agent is your next step. With BiggerPockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in minutes. Just head to biggerpockets.com/deals. Enter a few details about what and where you want to buy, and boom, instantly match with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all host and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.